should see your faces.
Listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Francesco in Charlie's avatar.
I'm Charlie in Francesco's avatar. I didn't know we were going to do this.
That's how they get you. This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve greater attention. How are you, Francesco?
I'm fine. How are you, Charlie?
I'm bloody cold. It's not nice around here. Your flat is very warm, but just generally, I'm just cold all the time. Okay, joining us this week is our good friend and my mum's favourite person, Emma Flan. How are you,
really?
Flan?
Really? Felt so much better for knowing that. I'm good.
Yeah, my mum just thinks you're the best.
Oh my God, I will gladly hold that title. Thank you. I cannot wait to see her this winter period.
You can say Christmas. We're not...
Holidays.
We're not going to cancel
it. Holidays!
You.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Emma, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Oh, goodness. So, I am currently based in Bordeaux, where I'm an English teacher, but I am a manc at heart. I'm from Manchester. I love films. I mean, my Instagram description is half Filipino, half Irish, and Sister Flan and a Hash Browns fan. And that's basically all you need to know.
Okay, yeah, that gives us a picture. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to clarify, your last name isn't actually Flan, it's Phelan.
No.
But everyone calls you Flan.
For six letters, it causes an immense amount of confusion.
Really?
Oh my God, no one can pronounce it. It is a rarity. My dad celebrates when someone pronounces my name correctly.
All right, well, to move swiftly on, today we are talking about the film Avatar, the 2008 blockbuster sensation directed by James Cameron. So, here's a synopsis. In the 22nd century, Jake Sully, a paraplegic marine, is dispatched to the moon Pandora on a unique mission, but becomes torn between following orders and protecting the Na'vi, an alien civilization. So guys, what do we think of this movie?
Well, having rewatched it around last week, I was pleasantly surprised by how much I actually enjoyed it, just because the past, 13 years of discourse around, does it deserve to be the highest grossing film of all time? Is it too boring of a narrative to have that title? Just having rewatched it on my small screen, I was like, well, if I weren't 13 when it came out, I would have definitely like gone out of my way to watch this on the big screen. It's just such a visual experience. So yeah, thumbs up for me.
I think it's really benefited over the last few years of how boring blockbuster cinema has become.
Yeah.
That this really sticks out. That if it came out now, we would be as excited for that as we were for one of the entries on this list. But I do think that there is something quite earnest and special about it, and it is, you know, visually very stunning. I think the question of whether it deserves to be the highest grossing film of all time, well, it's, to me, that's kind of a moot point. People went to see it and it made a lot of money because people went to see it. I don't understand deserves, but the bigger question is, does it deserve to, you know, be talked about more seriously or less seriously than it is? And I think we'll deal with that as we go on. What do you think, Emma?
Avatar is a funny one for me because, similar to you guys, When it first came out, I really didn't feel any strong opinion about it. And the fact that it held this huge title for as long as it did actually made me resent it quite a bit, because there was an element of, hang on, it wasn't that good. And I don't think it deserves that much credit. As a 13-year-old, my favourite film was Titanic. So I felt quite a butthurt that it had taken the title of my favourite film. Same director, this is true. But I went through a period until about maybe last month when you suggested we watch it, where I actively really disliked it. My IMDb score for it was, I think, a 2 out of 10. So it was fascinating to revisit it and realise that I was probably a little bit harsh, because as you guys said, it is such a visual experience, and I still maintain that the narrative itself isn't the most exciting or original. It's still a spectacle to engage with and to enjoy. So yeah, I really enjoyed having to rewatch it.
Yeah, the narrative is very cookie cutter, is how I would describe it, and it comes with its fair share of problems, which I'm sure we'll discuss later. But I do think that overall, what it tries to do, it does competently. Its heart is in the right place. If anything, rewatching it now, knowing that there's a sequel, it makes me more interested for the sequel, because the first entry in a new franchise is the one that kind of has to play it safe and just rehash, you know, established narrative tropes. So I'm really curious to see how they're going to bring it forward from here, because that's definitely going to be more interesting, even if not necessarily better.
Can I throw a hot take?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a hot take.
Yeah.
Would the movie, if it had a more challenging or original narrative, would it be harder to then get on board with the visual weirdness?
What do you mean weirdness?
Well, the fact that it's so detailed and othered, the fact that the entire ecosystem has its own rules and doesn't resemble our planet in some... Like if you compare it to, say, Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that even when you go into a bar in Tatooine, it still plays by the rules of a standard bar in, say, a Western.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with this, and yes, there are similarities between the Na'vi and indigenous populations, and the fact that the entire world of Pandora does play by a consistent set of rules that are alien to the ones that we know, do you think that a more complicated or challenging plot would be a distraction from that?
Well, I think a more complicated plot might have run into the opposite issue of over-explaining everything, and which is an issue that a lot of sci-fi or fantasy films have, of mm-hmm. just trying to inject too much lore and too much explanation, too much exposition into the story. Whereas I think Avatar's simplicity lets you just understand everything that's going on a very, very basic level, despite the fact that everything, you know, is following a set of very specific rules and has a very specific aesthetic.
Yeah,
it's true. I don't know. I think I totally see where you're coming from, Charlie. And yeah, it makes me wonder too, if the plot was more original, it doesn't necessarily have to be complicated. I see what you mean about the, you know, when films put so much lore and logic and over-explain and you feel overwhelmed. I think one of my issues with it for so long was that, you know, as a teenager, I saw a lot of similarities to films like Pocahontas, for example. It wasn't necessarily original. And so it just felt like a story I had already heard before. And so when people felt really absorbed into this whole world of Pandora, I was a little bit, as a teenager, I was like, well, I've seen this before. I don't feel that immersed because it's not that unique to me. Watching it, I just wasn't compelled that it was particularly original. Perhaps if it had been a slightly different story, but had less going on, but more, for want of a better word, uniqueness, perhaps that would have counterbalanced it. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's what I think the sequels are for. It's the fact that it took them like 15 years to start making them, and now they're making five at once. That feels a bit weird, but it doesn't feel inappropriate for a film like this to have a bunch of sequels.
Yeah, but yeah, like you said, it's very Pocahontas, also very Last of the Mohicans, in which the guy that plays the Na'vi chief is also in Last of the Mohicans, West Study. It's also Dances with Wolves, The Last Samurai, just a lot of stuff about...
It is very Dances with Wolves.
A white guy going into a foreign environment and integrating with the locals to mm-hmm. take on a colonial power, but also while still being the hero. I think this is a bit more complex because he literally becomes one of them mm-hmm. in a physical way.
I mean, like, he also is no longer disabled by doing that, which carries you know, another set of problems.
The disability politics angle of this film, I don't think people were really talking about, but I wonder if that bit has aged kind of poorly.
Yeah, and I think I see what the film tries to do, especially with that sequence where he first gets the Avatar body and starts running, is that what if, first of all, he's not born disabled, he's, you know, he's made disabled by a combat injury, I think. So the film is asking, what if there were a technology that allowed you to suddenly inhabit an abled body, much like the body you used to have? And it's certainly, you know, it's a moment of triumph and it's a moment of happiness, but there is a danger in writing this, like, I want to say, wish fulfillment fantasies.
And especially when the Na'vi represents so much freedom and confidence in nature, I think to have that counterbalanced by someone with disability, it's complicated. I don't think it's inherently problematic or toxic. I just think that maybe that's a thing that bears discussion from people more qualified than us. I will say mm-hmm. that first sequence when he gets into the Avatar is wonderful.
Yeah.
That is so good, and it's so immersive, and you fully understand the perspective in that. And for any reservations you have about the disability side of it, you totally believe what this particular individual character is feeling
mm-hmm.
in yeah. being able to, you know, run. And the fact that it's never really really talked about that much before that point. It's just all told from how Jake and Sam Worthington, I think, does this scene very well, reacts to being able to not just walk but run for the first time. I think that's, it's honestly, yeah, it's so immersive and quite powerful, I think.
It's true. I love that sequence as well. I see where you're coming from though, Charlie, in that it's, I don't know, as an able-bodied person, whether I've got the right to sort of comment, but certainly as a, someone watching, you feel with him in that moment when he does start to run around the complex. But it is food for thought whether or not, if it was sort of released today, what the commentary would be, whether it would even feature at all in that same way, or whether they'd sort of present it sort of different way.
I do like that the final decision that he takes to fully transfer his consciousness into the avatar body isn't motivated by the fact that the avatar body is able-bodied. It's motivated by his, you know, relation to the Na'vi people and his, you know, love story.
But also that his disability is directly linked to how he has been treated by the military and the danger he was put in by them.
Yeah.
So it's not just escaping his disability, it's also escaping the injury that he received in service of a military that we have seen throughout the course of the film to be corrupt.
Yeah, and like he fully rejects eventually the offer from the colonel to, you know, fix his legs. And I don't think at that point he's already planning to transfer his consciousness into the avatar body. I just think he fully embraces himself as he is at that, by that point.
Yeah, I think he, if I'm not mistaken, even though his human body is at risk at the end of the film, he manages to save the body in time. Unlike with Grace, where the attempt to kind of transfer her consciousness into the avatar form was desperation because her body, her human body was dying.
If I have one gripe with the narrative, just on a pure...
Only one?
Well, just on a pure narrative level, because as we said, it's cookie cutter, but like what it does well. It doesn't make any like glaring narrative mistakes. It's just, it's not very unique. But the whole Toruk thing, the big red dragon that he ends up riding to become a symbol of freedom, like that is never set up in the beginning of the film. It's addressed in a voiceover line as he's about to capture him. And then all of a sudden we're to believe that this feat of capturing this Toruk is so impressive that it makes the Na'vi people that he just betrayed and whose homeland his people destroyed all of a sudden like worship him as a leader. And I feel like that should have been set up a bit earlier, that that was a possibility. Everything else is just like, again, not very inventive, but at least, you know, it makes sense and it does the job.
I think it's so funny that he doesn't really betray them in any way that makes a huge amount of difference. It's just they feel the betrayal. I don't think anything that he does actually changes any of what the corporation and the military are doing.
No, but he omits the truth from them until that's the true. Very last moment, and that's, you know, it's not nice.
No, it's you're right. It's not
mean.
It's rude.
Yeah.
I think my gripe with the narrative is that you have this sort of rising action to like, oh, we're gonna, you know, have this. They've gone too far. We have to fight back. And there's like an hour and 10 minutes left of the movie, and there's stuff that like would have been the climax, but there's still so much left. And I don't know if this movie needs to be as long as it is.
I think I had a similar remark when I was watching it back and saw that, God, it's almost 3 hours long. I don't know. I think it gave me a little bit of dread. Like, oh God, it's. I think when I first watched it, I almost felt like it dragged. On rewatching it, I really find value in how kind of how slow the first hour is to really immerse you into Pandora. And so I think before rewatching it, I would have said, if there was an area to kind of shave down, it would be the first half. But now I think I see where you're coming from. Sort of the end third really goes on quite a while. At the same time, I think when you've been watching a film that is, as I know it's not the longest film in the world, but I guess if you're going to sign up to a 3 hour long film, as momentum goes, I don't think it sort of drops. It just maybe stagnates for quite a while.
It reaches that level and it keeps it with little ups and downs.
It peaks,
yeah,
like with an hour to go, and I think that's just a bit of a pacing problem, especially when like the first third is really fast paced, that he gets into the avatar within like 10-15 minutes of the film.
Does he?
Yeah, it's super quick.
Why me?
It's also a lot of job at the beginning is done by the voiceover, which again is another one of my gripes, because I think it works when he starts doing the video journal, but having it at the very beginning of the film to give the backstory about his brother and then have that same exposition repeated by the characters in dialogue really makes the voice over feel redundant.
Yeah.
Although it is funny when Sigourney Weaver is just negging him the whole time.
The voiceover is, as you said, really inconsistent. When the voiceover sort of started at the beginning, I was confused as to who, like at what point in Jake's story he is speaking from and what sort of retrospective voice it was. You know, was it him doing his video entries as still sort of a human? Is it him as the converted avatar at the end of the film? And then the fact that it's not consistent with the video entries, that really threw me. And it, for me, it made it feel really dated, actually.
Yeah, it was kind of, it was going for a almost like a Blade Runner theatrical cut feel to it.
Well, speaking of which, like, there is a director's cut, which might, I think the voiceover is still there, but there is more to like him on Earth and him traveling to Pandora, which I think they're right to cut just because you want to get to Pandora as quickly as possible. Yeah. You want to get into the Avatar as quickly as possible.
And it's already a long movie.
Exactly. I think this movie is good. I think it achieves a lot. It's just not necessarily my cup of tea, but I think if there are people that genuinely love it, I can totally understand why they do.
Yeah, and I remember another complaint that people had for years around its, you know, historical status as the highest grossing film of all time is that just a few years after it came out, no one could remember any of the characters' names. I think that was, people were framing it as like against Marvel, like, oh, we remember the Avengers, we don't remember the characters in Avatar. And it's like, well, the Avengers have been in 20 films, first of all, and their names are like Iron Man, they're not very hard to remember.
And they've been around since the 60s.
Yeah, but I do think that speaks to the fact that probably no one rewatched it after it came out. Everyone saw it in the cinema. It didn't have like a second life on streaming or on DVD. It exploded in the cinema and then it kind of fizzled out. So I think a better comparison than the Avengers would be other James Cameron films. Like, everyone remembers who Sarah Connor is, everyone remembers Ripley, and everyone remembers Jack and Rose, but no one remembers Jake Sully just because Jake Sully is just, he's an everyman. That's the entirety of his character, right?
Grace Augustine.
You saw it, you just rewatched it.
I'm curious to know your opinion on the relationship between Jake and Neytiri.
I think it's hot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I think it's skirted some of the potential problems. Like, she knows from the get-go that he's an avatar, so it's not like he's pretending to be a Navi and like tricking her into that. There is almost that, like, the element of a lot of Hollywood romances where the guy starts off the relationship by lying or withdrawing information from the other person, and then when the partner finds out at the end of the second act, there's this like moment of
I'm not mad that you did it, I'm mad that you lied about it.
Yeah, that is just exactly what happens in this film.
No, she's not mad. She's mad because, like, they're blowing up their tree.
Yeah,
she's like, yeah, you're an outsider, you're one of them.
Yeah,
and she's
dad
right.
Died. Yeah, but he also lied about it.
Yeah, but that's not why she's mad. This is better than that.
I think you're right. That's not the only reason that she's mad. But I think when we were rewatching it, I understand that there's a lot going on. Her home is about to plummet to the ground because the humans are about to cut down
the sacred tree.
The sacred tree. But she does say when she is becoming really upset just before the tree comes down, she is upset because he lied to her. That's what she vocalizes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's, well, again, less lie and more like, you knew that they were gonna come and do this the whole time, you helped them do it, and you're just now telling us. Like, that it's a shitty thing that he's done, but I think that in the framing of the film, like, he is, like, their relationship is organic. They fall in love with each other for who they really are, and
because, like, the glowing fluff, like, chooses him.
Oh yeah, because it's a sign from Enya, or Enya, no, Enya's the Irish singer.
Ewa.
Yeah, there you go.
I love Ewa. She's the best.
Yeah. But it's there's another film where he pretends like he's a Navi, or he pretends like he's a native of Pandora, and she doesn't know, and they fall in love without her knowing that he's a human. Now that's way more problematic, I think, than what we got.
I think he's trying his best. The biggest problem for Jake is that he's a big dumb idiot.
Yeah,
I think that's the problem. It's not that he lied, or he's just a big dummy.
Yeah,
we all agree with me.
And that's literally the point of the film makes several times.
I mean, I'm just kind of trying to imagine it like it was like a Nancy Meyers rom-com. I think that would be great. I'd love that.
But yeah, what about you, Emma? Why asking the question?
Why are you asking us a question on our podcast, Emma?
Do you have a burning opinion that you want
of it.
To?
I never really felt their chemistry, to be honest. I felt it more watching it this time, but I always thought it was a little bit shoehorned. I didn't really feel compelled by it. And I think that is, for me, something that really determines how much I click with a film, is how much, if there is going to be a love story, like, I want to buy in on it. And I never really did, even with rewatching it. So maybe it's it's just something that I missed, or it's personal. I think, especially when I was younger, watching it, because that informed my opinion of it for the next decade afterwards. I think my biggest gripe with it was that it was overrated. And I think it was because a lot of the time I formulated opinions on relationships between characters, and I just felt quite stale.
In the shadow of Titanic, especially.
Oh, well, there you go, especially. Nothing could compare to Jack and Rose.
Counterpoint. That archery scene is hot.
Yeah, the archery scene's all
the
right.
The archery scene is really hot. I love that scene.
No, but I think, yeah, no, the fault of the romance is that the narrative is so by the books that the moment you see the two of them, you know they're going to get together. So how's the film going to surprise us?
Also, I think it's hard to judge body language of mocap characters that don't embody physical characteristics that we recognize.
With that said, the expressivity of those 3D models is outstanding. Like, we haven't really talked in detail about this. I needed to constantly remind myself that this was 2009. And there were moments where the 3D models looked a bit rubbery, glossy, as 3D models tend to do, which, by the way, having watched the trailer to The Way of Water in the cinema, they look obviously like even better nowadays. But like, just all the avatar bodies having so much expression, so much emotion, looking so much like the like live action actors that portray them, but without, you know, like maintaining those characteristics and imprinting them into the aesthetic of the Na'vi without making them look too human or too Na'vi.
I think the Sigourney Weaver one looks too human. I think it looks too much like Sigourney Weaver.
I think that's true. Yeah, that's fair. The one I was the most impressed by was the one by the other scientist, the younger scientist with the... I forgot the name of the actor and the character.
Norm Spellman, played by Joel David Moore.
Yeah, that's him. Like that, he looks exactly like the actor, but I don't think he looks... It doesn't look as uncanny as Sigourney Weaver's one.
Yeah, I think they get the balance right.
Apparently, I was reading up about it, and they... Of all of the people, of all of the characters, they struggled the most with Sigourney Weaver.
I mean, she does have a distinctive face as well.
Well, that was it. And a lot of the features that made the Na'vi people distinctive, Sigourney Weaver naturally has opposite features. So they really struggled to animate her face as an avatar. And also, just a side note, I feel really bad for a very beige character who was given the name Norm.
I don't think Norm's beige.
I mean, I feel more sad for the precious resource being called unobtainium.
Unobtainium! Oh, God. Unobtainium exists. It's kind of a real thing.
That kind of made my toes curl as well, hearing it.
It sounds lame, but like, it is a theoretical thing that exists.
And I think they called it that because it's theoretical. But then when you make it real, it just sounds goofy.
So unobtainium is a term used in fiction, engineering, and common situations for a material ideal for a particular application, but impractically hard to get. So it existed before Avatar.
So the term existed, but it was literally a...
It exists as a concept.
Yeah, almost like a filler word to describe the MacGuffin
It's a bit like saying MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Or the Great What's It.
Yeah.
It's such a Goldilocks thing to have. It seems strange to have this conceptual thing as like, yes, here it is. It's floating on this device. We are mining for unobtainium.
It was very much the vibranium of 2009.
Anyway, so we are going a bit over time. So does anyone have any final thoughts, or can we talk about availability?
I have just one.
Yeah.
Giovanni Ribisi is so good in this movie. He is so funny, and I think he's so good as just the slimy corporate villain. I think he's wonderful. We didn't even talk about Zoe Saldana. I feel terrible.
Well, we don't even see her because she's always in the mocap avatar.
She's still doing it.
Yeah, I know. But like, I just like that both her most famous roles are some like monochrome alien, either here or Guardians of the Galaxy.
Hey, she was in Star Trek and she was herself.
She is the queen of blockbuster sci-fi, I think. I can only imagine her net worth. But I really like Zaldana's performance in this. Even though I didn't really feel, as I was saying earlier, that relationship between her character and Sam Worthington's character, I think as a performance, the scene that did stick with me from the first time I watched it and I sort of felt again was seeing the tree come down and hearing her just that guttural cry of utter anguish at seeing, you know, her home come down and also losing her father. I think it's impossible to not feel something there. And I mean, we'll go on to our different picks of films later, but it was certainly something that dictated what taste was left in my mouth after the film and what I wanted to pursue afterwards.
Is it fair to say that you connect to Zoe Saldana as an actor in this film, but not necessarily to Neytiri as a character? I think that's the way to look at it. You're very impressed by the performance, but you're never fully immersed into a particularly emotionally involving character.
See what you mean. I think I do. I am convinced by Neytiri. I do think she sells it really well. But I'm not convinced by the pair of them together. I think, you know, Grace mentions that her sister was murdered by the humans. It just, for me, it's so far-fetched that she would fall for someone like Jake, who is a human, who does represent so much of the anguish and pain in her life. That I think just feels so shoehorned and forced to me, that even as a character, who's Zoe Saldana plays incredibly well. There is a block there for me personally.
I mean, it's a Pocahontas conundrum. Like, if you don't believe Pocahontas narrative, you're not going to believe this one.
Now let's talk about availability. You can stream Avatar on Disney Plus. You can rent it on Rakuten TV, Amazon, Apple TV Plus, Google Play, Sky Store, Chili, Microsoft, and YouTube. And you can buy it on all of those channels as well. Okay, are you guys ready to move on?
We are.
Run the trailer.
शेर को पकड़ने के लिए शिकारी चाहिए।
एक आदमी है सर।
Okay, my pick for today is RRR, a 2022 film directed by S.S. Rajamouli, whose synopsis reads, a fictional history of two legendary revolutionaries, Bhim and Raju's journey away from home, before they began fighting for their country in the 1920s, the country which is India, under British colonial occupation. Now, I picked a film that, you know, it's not the most successful film of the year, but it's already very well known. And normally I like to go for alternates that are a bit more obscure, but I felt like with a film like Avatar, I wanted to pick something that was at least made as a blockbuster and at least aimed at a wide audience, that made a lot of use of high budgets and special effects, and that was an epic. And this film fits the bill really well for me. Not only do I think it's a great, like, piece of entertainment, it also resonates with Avatar so much in terms of its political commentary, which is not, you know, incredibly nuanced or incredibly deep, but it is, you know, an anti-colonial narrative. One of the two main protagonists is an ally of the colonial forces who infiltrates sort of the native population, and then, you know, throughout the narrative has to learn to, like, empathize with them more and fight for their side.
And he starts a relationship with a tribal person.
With
Bhim, who is, you know, from the forest.
Okay, with Bhim. Yeah, no, I tell you, I didn't know if you were making a joke about him being in a relationship with Bhim.
I mean, yes, they are.
But... But also, like, the fact that there's a film that, you know, it's by no means it's a high budget. It's not like it's some, like, political activist underground film, but it is still made from the perspective of the people who were colonized, rather than it being, you know, made from them being an American film about American colonialism. So it's a good film. And it's fun, and Charlie and I saw it together at the cinema, and we had a great time. So what do you guys think? Actually, what do you, Emma, think? Because I know what Charlie thinks.
Well, I've also said on mic what I think about this film before. Emma, what did you think watching this film? Did you know about it beforehand?
I did not know about it, I'm ashamed to say. And I am so envious that you both watched it in the cinema on a big screen with loud sound. Oh, what I would give to see this spectacle on the big screen. It was utterly bonkers in the best possible way. I was intimidated by the fact that it was over 3 hours long. I don't really have the habit of watching films quite as long as that. But it was a gift to be able to discover it. So thank you very much. I couldn't agree with you more, actually, in terms of the themes that resonated with Avatar. When I was looking for a film, this film ticked the boxes that I was sort of yearning to find, but I didn't manage to. My pick is a bit different in the end.
I did manage to tick those boxes as well, but we'll get to that later.
But it was just a joy to watch. It was, as I said, just such a spectacle. And yeah, the visual effects was something else.
And you saw it on Netflix, right?
I did watch it on Netflix, yeah.
So you must have seen it in the Hindi dub.
I did, yeah. Interestingly, the original version wasn't available to listen to. I could
no,
only
they
listen
just
to it in
out,
Hindi
they just put
English.
Out the Hindi version on Netflix. The original is in Telugu.
Which we saw it in Telugu, and you can, it's, as dubbings go, it's fine, but having seen the original, it did just sort of feel a bit off at times.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly like some of the speech didn't match the emotion of the scene that I was involved in.
Yeah.
But no, I think it broadly works. I think Rajamouli is a bit annoyed that the international release on streaming is in Hindi. It's, which again, maybe speaks to some of the problems some people have with the film's politics, that it is quite nationalist and majoritarian in its sort of framing of high caste Hindu characters.
Yeah.
And as, you know, British people, wait, you're not British. As Europeans, we can't necessarily speak to all of that, but I think that it is something to also consider.
Yeah, I think I have fewer problems with the nationalism itself, because it is kind of like about national identity in the face of a colonial power invading you. I have more problems with the almost like pan-Indian, as you said, majoritarian, like doesn't really address India as an incredibly heterogeneous country that it is, both language-wise and religion-wise.
Yeah, and I think that distributing it in Hindi just sort of underlines that point.
Yeah.
And I think that also the second half of the film does sideline Bheem quite a lot. And his sort of catharsis at the end is that he needs to learn from this, you know, man from Delhi.
Yeah.
So it's quite, it's a tiny bit patronizing towards the end. I think the character is treated with a lot of reverence, a lot of respect, and obviously it is based on a real person. But it is, I'm just saying, it's interesting and it's stuff that I'd like to look into more, but I just don't have the cultural shorthand to consider. The other thing is that when this movie is set, India is India and what we now know as Pakistan.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of fighting for India, despite the fact that a huge amount of these freedom fighters were also Muslim. And if you, the final sequence, without spoiling anything, pays tribute to all Hindu revolutionary fighters, which is interesting. They do omit Muslims from, I think the criticism this film totally omits Muslim characters is wrong, because the family that are hiding Bheem are shown to be Muslim.
Yeah, I also wonder like how much they would have been allowed to show or to include of that, you know, under the current Indian political regime, and still make the, you know, and still distribute their film with the, you know, the extent that they wanted to distribute it and ended up doing. So I do think that they kind of had to play it safe, but that's an issue with like all blockbusters all over the world. Like, you're never going to find a blockbuster that truly speaks truth to power or truly does a really deep, like, political deconstruction, because that's not where the money's coming from to make these movies.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it'd be very hypocritical of us to say that a Indian blockbuster is problematic in its political and ethnic representation and then be excited for the new Marvel movie.
In an episode where we're talking about Avatar, which
only
gets away with it because Blue Navi aren't actually real and they can't complain.
But they are all played by non-white actors. But no, I loved seeing this movie in the cinema. I really enjoyed watching it again, but I think I was more aware of some of the criticism, but it didn't stop my enjoyment of the film. I was just aware of some of the elements of it that I didn't notice the first time. But I still really enjoy the film and really think this could be a great way to get people interested in other types of Indian cinema, particularly other than Bollywood, because it's not a Bollywood film.
Yeah.
It's worth mentioning. I've heard a lot of people refer to it as one, and it's really, it's not. It's Telugu. So is it Tollywood or is Tamil?
Tamil is the, Tollywood, I don't know.
I think Tollywood is Telugu.
Okay, let me look that up very quickly. Tollywood, it's Telugu, you're right.
Yeah, so it's Tollywood, not Bollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that India is such a huge country and that different states have different film industries is really interesting, and it's a nuance to the way we think about Asian cinema that doesn't really get talked about, and I think it might be starting to a bit more, in no small part because of the popularity of this film among film fans.
Mm-hmm. And it does have some resonances with Bollywood, but like this true of the whole of Indian cinema, like from Bollywood to Telugu to Tamil, etc., that it does something that American blockbusters don't do, which is the, you know, the classical merging of genres, having musical action and romance at once. But that, you know, it's hardly unique to Bollywood is the thing.
I wish more Western blockbusters had musical numbers.
Well, yeah, because, you know, now that we got, you know, the more like dodgy criticisms out of the way, I really want to talk about the stuff that we love about this film.
Oh,
because I remember
absolutely.
When I saw this in the cinema, not only was it a great experience just watching it with an audience just cheering cheering at every moment. And also knowing that those moments that were cheerworthy because of the way that the narrative set them up and the way that within the narrative of the film, they delivered on a lot of setups and on a lot of just foreshadowings. It's just such a tightly constructed film. But also I loved it because I remember walking out of the cinema and saying, this is what Hollywood should be doing. Like Hollywood writers and Hollywood producers should be watching this kind of film and be like, oh, this is how we make a film that has huge commercial appeal, that does kind of like, you know, touch upon progressive political issues, but at the same time, it's fun and it's well made and it's a lot of things. And I just haven't had fun with a single English language blockbuster like this, probably ever since, I don't know, The Mummy 1999, which I was 4 years old when it came out. So I didn't watch it in the cinema, but yeah, something like that for me, probably.
I still think Mad Max Fury Road is great.
Oh, Mad Max Fury Road, you're right. It just, I guess I don't know, I kind of like associate Mad Max Fury Road to George Miller himself more so than to the whole system of Hollywood blockbusters.
Well, it's also not a Hollywood film, it's an Australian film.
That's true, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it has a tremendous amount of heart, I think, this film. And you just feel so, I don't know, engaged and on the ride with these characters that you meet. Because if I understand correctly, these two freedom fighters, they never met. That's the fictionalized element of it. Yeah. And it is just the bromance to end all other bromances. I'm not that familiar with Indian cinema. And as you say, there is such a plethora of different genres, different styles. So it was a pleasure to get to know it. And one of the things that I loved the most was just the conventional, quote unquote, rule book of what either makes a good film, what makes a film realistic and convincing. That rule book was just thrown out the window. Mm-hmm. And you could just, once you do that, I think there is such liberty and freedom that maybe Western, more Hollywood filmmaking is so confined by. Everything is so explained, everything has to have a reasoning behind it, and if it's not realistic, it's not convincing. And with this, it was not realistic at all, and I was so convinced by the world that we were in, and I think that made it really special. And I definitely enjoyed just the options that became available by not being confined to that little box of, we need to make this realistic, we need to make this fight sequence totally feasible. Don't need to.
I would just make the counterpoint that I'd hesitate to say that it throws away the rule book, because it is a big budget movie made in a very different cinema system. So it may just be, it's a rule book that we just aren't familiar with. And that's fine. And that's still refreshing to us. But I think that's more of an argument for why we should watch as many movies from as many different places as possible.
When my partner saw it, they said, oh, this is the most anime thing outside of anime. Which again, it's the action sequences are heightened. And just to describe a few of them, just because like we're talking about this, but like not giving out any descriptions. Like, I think the one of the climactic like midpoint fight sequences involves actions like one of the characters picking up a tiger and throwing it at a guy to get him more by the tiger. There's a sequence near the beginning where Raju, in order to show himself off in front of the, you know, his you know, British white bosses, he goes into a riot.
It's one of the first scenes,
like,
in the film.
Yeah, yeah, of like what looks like hundreds of people, and it just starts like fighting all of them at once. And it's not done in a way where it's like a superhero just sweeping through and mauling.
It's very weighted,
it's very kinetic. Like, you can see him getting punched, and you can feel the, like, almost like the pain in his bones and in the people he hits. And like every hit is marked by excellent sound design that really makes it feel weighty, and everything is choreographed in a way that shows the actions and highlights the action. Whereas I feel like very often Hollywood films, especially superhero films, which are, you know, the most popular right now, tend to do the opposite, tend to cut around the action, cut away from it, and not show the actual impact of the punches. So yeah, this film is just a masterclass in sound design and action choreographing.
It's beautiful as well. I think some of the shots that are created are just stunning, absolutely stunning. I think if you were to pause the film at any point, which is probably likely if you're watching on Netflix and you've got 3 hours, there is just so much detail, and it was just a pleasure visually And as you say, I didn't really consider it at the time, but you're right, the sound design was really so expertly done.
And last point from me is going to be the soundtrack, because this is also a musical. The songs are bangers, like they're absolute bangers. And oh my God, so many of the songs. That's the, you know, the main song, the main motif, which is probably the best one. No, the one that goes,
the one that plays when they first meet and become friends, and it shows sort of their relationship as best buds.
It's their theme song, but also the one during the dance fight, because there's a dance fight in this film. Like I feel like we talked so much about its politics, so I haven't sold why it's so great. There's
a dance battle against colonialism.
Yeah, like because you don't need to fight the British with punches. You can
outdance them. Yeah, they're very easy to outdance.
Yeah,
there is an element of like the power of song is the most powerful thing in the world.
Also weapons,
guns.
Which, to be fair, it's like when you're being invaded by a militarized colonial power, I think the film does make a point of like, oh, the way that you actually fight them is by inspiring the people to like rally up against them and to, you know, and to start a counter revolution. But
practically, they still need guns.
Yeah, you're not gonna fight them with sticks and stones.
I want to just make a point. Shout out to Ray Stevenson and Alison Doody as villains.
Oh God, we haven't talked about the villains.
Oh God, yeah.
So Governor Scott Buxton and Cassandra Buxton. If you don't know Alison Doody, she is a Nazi in The Last Crusade.
Oh my God, is she?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And Ray Stevenson played the Punisher in one of those movies.
Oh my God, they're so perfectly cast.
They are. Interestingly, both Irish.
Oh, that makes it so much better.
I agree.
It's fine now.
Yeah.
He's Northern Irish. She's from Dublin. But it is interesting that they cast two Irish actors to play the evil British people.
Oh, it's so much better than they're playing caricatures of British colonialists now.
That does enhance it, actually, because they are fairly irredeemable as characters go.
But I do love that she just carries around a whip.
Just for
just in case. She loves blood.
Yeah. A barbed whip.
Yeah. She seemed to just have on her at the time. Not to spoil that scene, because that is a harrowing scene, but that bit is so funny. Speaking of...
Here, take mine.
Speaking of, you know, relationships you don't fully buy, how do we feel about Beam and Jenny's relationship in this?
Forced straightness in a gay film.
Yes.
Like
100% agree.
Like I think the women in this film that their love interests matter very little, and they're just there as a convention.
One of them is a huge like Indian movie star. The one who plays Sita.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well,
is it Ali Abad?
Yeah. What was she in?
I don't know.
I'm not.
Yeah, let's not do that. Yeah. We can't do it. But it is really interesting when Raju, you know, sees Sita and he's with Beam, his body language is so much more stiff with her than it is with him.
Incredibly so.
It's so funny. And I don't think that this film is deliberately homoerotic, but it is really funny how they don't have the same chemistry with these female love interests.
Mm, who are meant to be such a motivator, at least in one of the characters' cases, for why he is doing what he is doing. Yeah, no, it's...
You know, Jenny was meant to be played by Daisy Edgar Jones in Normal People.
Was it really?
Yeah. I think what's her name? Olivia Morris. I think she's fine, but, you know.
Totally harmless.
But not really a competitor in terms of relationship to Raju.
No, not quite. It was such a spectacle to watch. It's well worth 3 hours. I think as someone who doesn't really know, as I said, Indian films that much, it is, I think, a great way in. And I just love, I was so pleasantly surprised by how many parallels there were to Avatar. So as a potential film, because you watched Francesco, I just thought it was absolutely inspired.
And something I'd like to add is, you know, it's not in cinemas anymore. Maybe it's going to have some limited screenings, but if you are going to watch it with other people. Like it's the way it's meant to be seen.
Availability, it's available on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's all. Not in Telugu.
Not in Telugu, so yeah.
Frustratingly so. I would love to watch the original version because, as you say, the only gripe I had probably was that at times the dubbing, but there was some disconnect.
Okay, should we move on to Technolust?
So when do I get to see them?
You can't see them. It's only theory. I want to see for myself what it's like in the jungle.
Oh, I love shopping.
Where'd you get that outfit?
I just wanted to look like everyone else I see on the net.
Remember, no one's supposed to know you're real.
Technolust is a 2002 film directed by Lynn Hirschman Leeson. Anxious to use artificial life to improve the world, Rosetta Stone, a biogeneticist, creates a recipe for cyborgs and uses her own DNA in order to breed three self-replicating automatons, part human, part computer, named Ruby, Olive, and Marine. What do we think, guys? Weird movie. Very weird movie.
Actually, this film had been on my radar for a long time, so I was so happy when you picked it, because I was like, oh, I can finally get around to watching it.
I hadn't seen it when I picked it. It just looked cool.
Yeah,
I did wonder whether it was one of those films that you had seen before or hadn't, so that answers that for me.
Well, like, you know, speaking of sci-fi and special effects, we're talking about Avatar being so ahead of its time. Technolust is a film of its time. Like, it's a film that is perfectly encapsulated in that 2002 Web 1.0 aesthetic. But it's not a detriment to it. Like, it fully embraces it.
It's campy, low-budget, filmed within a very tight schedule. Some of the special effects are janky and goofy as hell, and I kind of love it for it.
Well, because they are. I mean, most of the actual special effects that we see are inside the computer screens.
But on a microwave.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because they live
so
in a microwave.
It's so funny!
This film was incredibly camp and I loved it for it. You said about the other film, for RRR, how really don't watch it by yourself. I would say the same about this film. It is just enhanced by having company with you when you watch it, I think.
Mm. Preferably three copies of yourself. very, very saturated.
Kimonos.
But satin robes as well. Yeah.
People love putting Tilda Swinton in kimonos.
As soon as it started, I was like, ah, here we go again. Tilda Swinton playing a racially ambiguous character that could have been played by someone who was not, who was Asian.
Also, Tilda Swinton playing multiple characters in a film, which she does in Suspiria that we talked about a while ago in a special she does in this. And I don't think she does that in any more films.
And we will never talk about...
Oh, no, there is another one. Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar.
Yes,
okay.
She does in Hail Caesar. That's it, though.
Yeah, that's it.
I love Hail Caesar, and I totally forgot that she does that in that movie. I think that movie's great, though.
For another time.
She plays four roles in this, and I found out... Do you know how long she was on set for to play four different characters?
How long?
5 days. She filmed her parts of this movie in 5 days, because that's all they could afford her for.
But that explains... I mean, like, the three robot characters... Well, two of the three robot characters are mostly in the same location throughout the entire film.
Yeah.
So that explains that. It's mostly Ruby and Rosetta Stone herself who need to move around and interact with more characters.
But that's insane. Yeah. It's a really good performance.
I mean, it's still there. What do you
expect? Four different performances. She did it all in 5 days. That's amazing.
5 days, four wigs.
Four terrible wigs, by the way.
Awful, awful wigs.
So playing a scientist and her three robot duplicates, clones, however you want to look at them. I like that they don't fully explain it.
Also, they're not, they're somewhere between robot and like digital avatars. And like, again, it's a very like of its time, like what will digital technology become in the future?
Reminded me a bit of Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
Especially considering her hair and the Asian aesthetic on a white woman.
Speaking of hair, the best scene is the film is where she goes to the hairdresser and says... Make me look like Bjork.
But that scene is totally unnecessary. It adds nothing to the plot. It's just there.
Well, it adds the fact that we know that it's 2002 and Rosetta Stone is a Bjork fan.
But then that hairdresser comes back later and does sort of the same non-job on another kid. It's great. I think they're collecting sperm. And that's how they are powered?
Yeah, because...
Not to be gross, this is the plot of the movie.
Yeah, so they're like, again, like semi-like robotic, semi-synthetic. And it's implied that the synthetic, like the organic part of their being is kept alive by Y chromosome. So they need to extract sperm from men and inject it.
And if I'm not mistaken, they have a spermometer.
They do.
They do.
Obviously.
Spermometer.
I mean, we all do.
Speak for yourself, Charlie.
And the other thing is that the men that they are collecting semen from are all getting sick and are all getting this weird marking on their head with a number. It's very odd.
Well, they're getting, I think what the film is trying to say is that they're getting a virus, which is both in the sense of a computer virus and a sexually transmitted virus. And yeah, that's what the film is playing around with. I think it's great.
I don't think this is a spoiler, that because they are an artificial intelligence, when they then sleep with human men, they essentially give them a computer virus. So the way that a computer virus presents itself on human men is, for me, hilarious.
As Which you is? Like, you can describe it.
Well, yeah, as you say, there is sort of this barcode. A barcode that on their forehead. And their computer goes a bit funny as well, doesn't it? Their hard drive gets wiped.
Yeah, no, their hard drive crashes, and then they get a barcode on their forehead, and they become impotent.
Yes, that's it. And I think of all of the scenes that talk about the computer virus, my favourite performance is by far the doctor who they speak to, who inexplicably whispers all of his lines.
Well, I think, like, I don't know, again, I think it feels like the film is almost making fun of the, like, the prudishness and secretiveness of, like, having to speak about such things as STVs or STDs. But it's almost like the film speaks to the paranoia around stuff like the Millennium Bug in 2000, but also this very, like, male paranoia around, like, mysterious women just spreading disease around and things like that. It's kind of like merging the both of them while at the same time creating this like narrative where there's really not a distinction between what is digital and what is cybernetic and what is organic fundamentally.
Talk a bit about how it might relate to Avatar.
Oh yeah,
obviously
yeah.
You have, even though she doesn't transfer her consciousness, the idea of artificial bodies and these programs posing as humans, never actually claiming to be anything that they're not, but they are walking around in these bodies that require maintenance in a way that human bodies don't. And watching this, it just kind of made me think, how do you think the Na'vi feel about humans walking around as Na'vi? Even though they're never pretending to be Na'vi, do they not find it a bit offensive?
Well, for me, that's, I'm gonna go back to it again. That's why I take issue with Neytiri and Jake, because I think she'd take massive issue with that. So the fact that she falls in love with him, for me, is just, it doesn't make sense. Especially, I mean, I would find it uncanny at best if the whole massacre that happened between the humans and the Na'vi didn't happen, but it did. So not only is it uncanny, it just feels plain wrong.
Well, they talk about the Avatar bodies as demons. Like, it's implied that they don't fully understand the technology behind them. They have superstitions around the Avatar bodies. Like, they know that they're unnatural. They know that they're not normal. And they're not real.
And they're right.
Yeah.
They're right. It's not natural. It's not real. And yeah, it's almost like I'm going to date this person who's wearing blackface constantly anytime we're together. It feels a bit like that.
Almost like this.
A little bit. Yeah. Especially yeah. Because with the Na'vi in Avatar, it's explained that all of the trees, all of the nature that exists there is so sentient. And with the, I can't remember the name of this, the holy tree that they go to, but they can essentially go into the archives of history and see everything that came before. They can hear the echoes of their ancestors. And so through all of the Na'vi's history, they know that there's been nothing like this before. I think it must be, if anything, enhanced how alien the humans are to them.
If someone was trying to integrate with me and like my community, and the way that they did it was, I know you're freaked out by the fact that we look different, but look, we have these artificial bodies, so we look like you now. Isn't this so much more relaxing? That's so freaky. It's the reason the T-800 looks so much scarier when he looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger than when he looks like a robot.
It must fall right into the uncanny valley, surely.
I mean, oh, I just feel bad. I mean, I feel bad for the Na'vi throughout the whole film, but just, that's such an awkward situation to be in.
Which is why the narrative of RRR makes way more sense, because Raju is actually ethnically Indian. He's just, he works for the British colonials, but yeah. he's not a British guy who just puts on a fake mustache and goes like...
So, yeah, back to Technolust.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about this movie without giving more away. It's so weird.
Well, I will say that one of the main links with Avatar is the line, "I dream better in blue."
That's true. He does dream better in blue.
Yeah, and one of the avatars of Tilda Swinton is blue, and she's called Marine. She's the blue one. Yeah.
Plot twist.
I will also say that Ruby, the red avatar in Technolust, has this insane car, which you see the first time and you think, oh, this is like a weird sci-fi world with a weird sci-fi car. And then in a scene, you see her drive that car down a street and all the other cars are ordinary.
Oh my God.
This film actually reminded me quite a bit of, and I say this with so much love, it reminded me a little bit of The Room.
Okay. Elaborate, because it's interesting. Similar period.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I think it's what you were saying, Francesco, about it really being a film of its time. And if I'm not mistaken, both of them are set in San Francisco, no? So there is a constant panning shot of the San Francisco Bridge. So whenever that happened, I had the urge to be like, oh, to kind of follow it. And there were just so many seemingly inexplicable choices, so many unexplained things in the film that you just had to accept. Like, yeah, she communicates to her avatars through a microwave, and the detective constantly has a plaster on his face and it shifts in every scene where it is.
They collect sperm.
They collect sperm, and yeah. That's just the way it is.
The protagonist is a scientist called Rosetta Stone. Like, I should say two things though, because like I don't want people to take this comparison the wrong way. First of all, the special effects here are better than in The Room, but also like, whereas in The Room a lot of the unexplained stuff is the fruit of just the megalomaniac ego of the director, Technoless doesn't feel like a vanity project at all. It just exudes so much like personality.
Yeah, it's a better film than The Room.
Oh, massively so.
We should have a Room episode, by the way.
We should, actually. That'd be a fun
Emma, do you want to be on another Room episode?
If you'll have me back.
My God, that'd be a fun one to pick alternates for, because you'd have to pick bad films.
You would have to pick
You'd have to pick like really bad films.
I'd pick an Ed Wood film.
Oh yeah, that, but not Plan 9, like a lesser known one.
No. Yeah. Okay, if there's anything else on Technoless, it's a very short film, and I don't want to spoil too much of it, but it's so bonkers, and it's so lovingly made, and I think there are genuinely some really interesting ideas about sexuality and humanity and almost spirituality through those things. I do have a lot of respect for this film,
yeah.
And I didn't pick it because I thought it was, you know, janky and weird. I had no idea what this film was when I suggested it. Having watched it, I feel vindicated, because it is a very interesting counterpoint to one of the biggest movies ever made. This is one of the smallest movies ever made, but it's dealing with some similar themes.
Yeah.
Availability, you can stream it on Mubi.
Yeah.
And nowhere else.
Well,
soz, guys.
That's your excuse to cancel your Netflix subscription after you've seen RRR and get a movie subscription. Yeah, fuck that. Yeah, no.
Well, yeah, our next film's on Netflix.
I can't pronounce subscription. Why do you have so many consonants in this language?
Oh, shut up. All right, now let's move on to our next film.
We needed a miracle. And then we got one. This beautiful and special little creature will be a revolution in the livestock industry. Our super pigs will not only be big and beautiful, they will also leave a minimal footprint on the environment, consume less feed, and produce less excretions. And most importantly, they need to taste fucking good.
So Okja is a 2017 film by Bong Joon-ho, and it follows a young girl called Mija who risks everything to prevent a powerful multinational company called Mirando Corporation from kidnapping her best friend, a massive animal called Okja.
A massive animal.
A super pig. He's a super pig who has the face of a manatee.
Yeah, can we just agree now that super pigs are kind of hippopotamus-ish?
They are somewhat.
I didn't think manatee, I thought hippo.
It's kind of got the form of a pig, but the sort of waterproofness of a hippo and the face of a manatee.
Yeah, I think I have a book that describes their design process. Should bring it out sometime. But yeah, it's fun. It's more fun if we discuss it without knowing what actually went into the design. Just from our perspective, like, well, what is this? I do appreciate that they try to make her look like an animal, because one problem I have with a lot of like animalist and like, you know, pro-animal rights films is that the way that they make you empathize with the animals is by what I call Disneyfying them, just giving them huge like puppy eyes and making them look like basically human babies with an animal body. Like, she actually looks like, you know, not an animal that actually exists, but yeah.
I really like the Disneyfication of animals. I think that that's why Tim Burton's Dumbo works quite well. And Jon Favreau's Lion King really doesn't. Because something that's too photorealistic, it's very hard to, A, empathize and also tell the difference between different animals. I think that what Okja does, I think it gets the balance right. The anatomy and the physiology of this animal does feel weighted in reality and biology.
I think that's the key to it. The difference with the remake of the Disney, The Lion King, I think, is the fact that all of the animals are just around other animated animals, and it doesn't have to be next to a real person, a little girl, or running around a city or whatever. And so, yeah, to be able to ground it and it be a feasible animal that no one has ever seen before is a delicate balance, but I think it does it really well.
Yeah, and I have more points to make to this, but before we get into like this full discussion, Emma, why don't you tell us why you chose this film so we can properly start the section.
I chose this film because for me, it kind of sated, I said earlier, sort of what that taste that was left in my mouth at the end of watching Avatar. I kind of finished Avatar essentially resenting humans and our need to consume and consume and consume. And one of the things I found interesting about Avatar as a setup is its idea of what happens when we deplete all of our resources on Earth and what lengths will we go to be able to continue consuming to the extent that we are used to. So I really wanted to find a film that dealt with themes of that and also showed some of the uglier sides of human nature, especially sort of the corporate side, and maybe something a little bit futuristic. And for me, Okja does explore that really well. It's not a spoiler to say that the film is focused on this the super pig that is born about how do we find an alternative meat that is that humans are able to consume, that is good for you, that doesn't mean killing. It's not a real animal because it is created in a lab somewhere. That's not the story that's released, but it's, yeah, how do we deal with demand for meat, sating an audience who don't want to eat animals anymore, and yeah, finding well, another means to do it.
Well, I think it's also about the myth of sustainability, because I think crucially they don't reveal to the public that Okja is lab created and genetically modified. They claim that these super pigs are entirely natural, but the drive is that they don't have an impact on the ecosystem. Like removing them from the ecosystem doesn't affect it because they are in part of that. So I think it's the idea of like, if something is sustainable, is it still ethical? Are you still not causing the suffering of a living being? And I think I think this film is such a brilliant choice for Avatar because, once again, you know, just like RRR, not the most obscure film of all time, but it is a film that, like Avatar, uses digital technology and uses CGI to explore the potential of the future of human behavior. And this film uses CGI to such an interesting extent because Okja is an artificial animal within the narrative and is an artificial construct, like materially, like she, you know, she's animated, and yet you still empathize with her as a living being.
Totally.
What I do think, because this connects back to the point I was making earlier, is kind of my problem is that they go out of their way to make Okja look like an animal because I think they want you to empathize with her as an animal, not as an animal that looks like a human, and you're empathizing with her because she reminds you of a human baby. And we can go back to the Lion King point, but I think the Lion King is like, the problem with that is that they're not actually animals. They're like, they speak and they have like human, like so you should need to distinguish between them individually. Whereas in Okja, she's meant to be an animal. She's not meant to be anthropomorphized, but like her behavior is like she has human intelligence. Like there's a scene early on where like she devises like a like pulley contraption to like save Mija from falling off a cliff.
I don't know if that's human intelligence. I think what Okja does quite well as a film is display animal intelligence. The fact that animals do things to survive because that's how evolution works.
And I think pigs especially are, it's interesting that like we were saying earlier, considering this animal doesn't necessarily resemble a pig, they still use the term pig to describe it. It's still called a super pig. And I think part of that is because pigs are known to be very sentient, very intelligent beings. And so by calling it a super pig, perhaps part of that enhanced intelligence is also kind of super.
And also that people are familiar with pig meat.
Yeah. And
if you remember, you probably weren't in the UK for this, but do you remember the horse meat scandal?
Yeah, I remember that vividly.
Where everyone freaked out because Tesco's like £1 beef burgers had a large amount of horse meat in them, and people were absolutely freaking out. And part of that was just that they hadn't been told what they were eating, but it's not like horse meat has taken off since then after we found out we couldn't really tell the difference. I think we are, and this it goes to this thing about myths of sustainability and also presentation of it, is that people are comfortable eating something if they believe it comes from a pig, even if it's a different sort of pig. I'm sure that the super pig, as they call it, has some pig DNA, but it's not just a big pig. And just the fact that's never mentioned, but they talk about making sausages and bacon.
Every part of the pig can be turned into a meat.
Yeah.
There's a line in the film where they say like literally everything but the squeal can be eaten.
Which is terrifying.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Guys, I think we've made a huge mistake though, and we might need to go back and fix something. Tilda Swinton's in this movie.
She only plays one character though, right?
Well, that's what I thought, but oh my god! She plays two!
My bad, guys.
We really should have noticed. They played because they're twins. We should have noticed.
Yeah, but like they could have put a red robe on one and a blue robe on one.
That's true.
Would have been able to tell them apart.
Oh,
How many wigs did she wear?
Two.
She didn't wear fake teeth in this one, did she?
Yes.
Oh.
For both characters. Making it, I think, the second Bong Joon-ho movie where Tilda Swinton wears fake teeth.
At least she didn't wear a kimono this time, right?
She kind of does, right?
She does.
Oh, no.
Next thing you're going to tell me is that we have Giancarlo Esposito playing a caricature of an evil corporate overlord.
Oh, that would be impossible.
Nah, let me guess that.
Oh, my God. Wait, okay, last one, but like, there's no way they got Jake Gyllenhaal just to play like a creepy, skeezy media
completely
guy.
Deranged.
What is Jake Gyllenhaal doing in this film?
So I thought he was a big part of the movie, and then he disappears for a long time, and I think, okay, maybe it was like a one scene cameo, and then like he is back towards the end. It's a truly unhinged performance.
And I don't know, because like, obviously he's a TV personality, and he kind of does a children's show, so he has this like persona in front of the cameras, but then he keeps that persona up here even when the cameras aren't running. That's just who he is. This character.
I think it's that first scene where you actually see him and he's like such a dick, and then as soon as the cameras are on, he's really good. Yeah. Like he's totally believable as that sort of character.
But then for the rest of the film, he just brings it no up and up and up and up. He never like slows down for a second.
Yeah, I think his arc is a bit weird. I will say, of like other supporting characters, I mean, the main girl whose name... The main actress who plays Mi-je...
An So-yeon, she's great. And
she's so good. I will quickly, because you mentioned what Laura said about RR being the closest thing to an anime that isn't an anime. Mm-hmm. I think this is the closest thing we will ever get to a live-action Ghibli movie.
It's not bad.
Which goes a bit darker than most Ghibli movies do at some points.
That's true. I mean, The Wind Rises is pretty dark.
No, that's true.
But particularly when those bits where Okja is just wandering around the farm, it's so cute, and it's like, oh, it's like Totoro.
Just the relationship between her and Mi-je is so...
And I think that's another point of comparison between Avatar and Okja, is that it really does take that time to just plonk you in their world and watch it, obviously, like in a slow TV kind of way. They're milling about their day, going to the stream, fishing, being in the beautiful Korean countryside. So much so that when they do go into the city, it's just such a sharp, horrible contrast, an assault on the senses to suddenly be thrown into Seoul or New York. Harsh contrast between the beautiful countryside and the man-made world.
First they go to Seoul, then they go to New York. So yeah.
And they both suck.
God.
That whole sequence in the office building is amazing. It's like Home Alone or something. She's so like ingenious, but without ever overly precocious.
So this one, she breaks into the office building after Okja gets taken by the corporation and just body slams into a glass pane.
Yeah. That scene's so good.
Oh god.
And like the tension that builds as you're not sure, is it gonna smash?
And then shortly after, there's the introduction of the vegan activist group, who are called
Animal Liberation Front,
who is such an interesting array of actors. The two most recognizable ones are going to be Paul Dano, who like, he wears a balaclava for like the first like 15 minutes that he appears, and you can still tell it's Paul Dano.
I couldn't. When he took the mask, I knew he was in it, and then he took the mask, I'm like, oh, that's Paul Dano.
No, I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't know he was in it. I saw him with the ski mask, and
that's,
I was like,
so
that's Paul
funny.
Dano. It's clearly Paul. Then he took it off.
Yeah. And Steven Yeun,
who is Hollywood's choice for like, oh, we need an actor who can speak both English and Korean, and an actor as an interpreter between the two.
He does it very well.
Yeah.
He's so good in Minari.
Yeah.
There's also Lily Collins who's in it, right?
Yeah, she's in it. She's also really, I think she's Red?
Yes.
The driver?
Yeah, he's obviously a very recognisable name now.
The other thing I love about Paul Dano's character is how bad he is at disguises.
There's one point where he shows up in a disguise where it's like he's dressed as a valet and he's wearing glasses, and he tells Mi-je, it's me. He takes his glasses off so she can recognize him and then puts them back on.
It's very
so
Clark Kent isn't Superman. Clark Kent wears glasses. Superman doesn't wear glasses. Oh god, I love Paul Dano so much. I think he's so good in this movie.
He's brilliant. I think
everyone's great in this movie.
Yeah.
How committed he is to the Animal Liberation Front in such a, I don't know, he's such a stickler to the rules. And I love the way that presents itself in its many forms. I don't want to spoil anything.
No. So we were giving Tilda Swinton a bit of a hard time. I think Tilda Swinton is really good as both the sisters. I do think you really understand someone that is trying to be a good person despite compromising everything, believing that if they believe that they are a good person, that will allow them to override the fact that they, an entire corporation, are doing terrible things in their name. Mm. I think it's a really complicated character, and she just keys into, and this is the thing that we're finding about Tilda Swinton, if you compare it to Technolust, she is able to key in so well to a couple of key characteristics and build a character out from that rather than underplaying it. She knows how to overplay something very competently without ever going into Jared Leto territory.
Well, that's kind of a low bar.
Also, one of my favourite actors is in this, Shirley Henderson, who is Moaning Myrtle from the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
Who does she play here?
She's one of the assistants.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I should have recognised her from the voice, because she has a very distinct voice. Yeah.
She's so funny in this. And there's a montage where she's like, yeah, everything on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, it's like all of Instagram. And like, she's just rattling off social media company names for some reason. I just found the funniest thing in the world. Oh, it's wonderful. And like, there's some really cool action sequences in this movie.
And the music as well that accompanies the action shots, I think, is just a match made in heaven. There's a particular scene where Okja is roaming around the Seoul subway and it's utter chaos. And the music that accompanies it, I think, just it just makes it such a delight to watch for all the chaos that is happening on screen.
Oh, yeah, when Okja is just ramming through the department store and just destroying everything. And
it's an underground station apartment store, so it's super claustrophobic compared to the wide open farm.
Yeah, but it's almost like a Blues Brothers chase at one point, because you have Okja running away with Midja chasing her, the Animal Liberation Front chasing them, the police chasing the Animal Liberation Front, and then the people from the company, like Okja's, like basically like the people tending to Okja from the company building chasing them.
I love that you think of it as Blues Brothers, whereas in England we'll just think of it as Benny Hill.
Oh yeah, Benny Hill. Yeah.
Not that you don't understand who Benny Hill is, but like that was sort of the go-to pop culture reference for me, which maybe is showing that I was raised on a different generation's TV. I just watched a lot of UK TV Gold.
Well, it is a scene where you could apply the Benny Hill soundtrack and it wouldn't look out of place.
Oh, we should.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would be great.
That's actually the director's cut.
Yeah, this movie is really lovely, and I think it does... It's not subtle in its message, but also when you're dealing with stuff as important as climate change or animal rights, why be subtle?
Yeah, and it's making a point like that the things that it's showing are happening to super pigs in the film are not different from what happens to real animals in like real farms.
It resembles the things that we know is happening but choose to ignore, and so what it does is bring the thing that you're repressing at the back of your mind every time you eat meat to the front of your mind so you can't ignore it. I think it, and using a fictional subspecies is a very powerful way of doing that.
There are so many people who went vegan because of this film, which I think like basically undermines all the nitpicks that a lot of people might have about, oh, is it a perfect like vegan film? Is it a perfect animal rights film? Maybe not, but
that's
like
not
it does the job. But you know, all the, you know, most loaded films of the, not the genre, but of this kind that deal with this topic tend to be documentaries, tend to be films that expose actual malpractices in the industry. But this film is not trying to do that. This film is trying to move, to stir an emotion in the people that watch it in order to maybe go off and inform themselves a bit more.
Or in some cases, as we found on our Inception episode, using documentary footage in a dramatic film.
Yeah, I was just thinking that because this element, well, there's a moment where they show some footage of Okja in a quite a precarious situation as a means to try and shock people in the film about what's going on behind the scenes. But yeah, it does it in such a way that it's not the main point of what's going on. It's sort of as a distraction for another plot device. And so it is there, but it's not ever like, look at this terrible thing. You can't, yeah, look at this. Here's some footage of super pigs being slaughtered. You will have this opinion about it. It's never dictated in that way.
And there's this uneasy subtext of, we care because we know Okja. We care because of, we know her name and we know her story, but this is happening to hundreds and thousands of animals that we don't know, and we don't think about it because we don't know them.
Mm, yeah.
So let's just talk availability. This poster that I found on Just Watch is crazy.
Oh, it's great.
It looks like a totally different
film. It makes them look like a happy family.
Can you see it?
Oh my god, that is not at all the image of Okja that I would think of.
No, it's not. This is available on Netflix. So watch it there.
Seems to be that the films that are available on Netflix tend to be available only on Netflix. But also, no, two of the films that we talked about today are Netflix original distributions. So yeah.
There was actually a bit of trouble. I'm based in France, and there's a rule in France about distribution such that Okja was not allowed to be released into the cinemas here in France. So not a lot of people here actually know about it. I watched it with my housemate who had seen it because it comes up on Netflix as a recommended film because we watched. But in terms of reach, it's really quite limited here, which surprised me.
They used Netflix originals used to have longer cinema runs up until a few years ago. But no, I think this year, the few Netflix originals that came out were in the cinema for maybe a week and then immediately went to streaming. I guess that's where they make most of their money. So
there's some sort of rule against it here where it can't be released into the cinema if it's also being released online. But anyway, that sucks.
Because
more stuff should be in cinemas. They're fun.
Exactly. I want to see RRR. Do we refer to it as triple R or RRR?
I call it triple R just because I don't want to sound too much like a pirate.
RRR. RRR stands for
Rise Roar Revolt. It actually stands for the name of the director and the name of the two stars.
Oh yeah, Rajamouli.
So Rajamouli, who is the director, Rao, who plays Bhim, and Ram, who plays Raju.
And if I'm not mistaken, they keep RRR in all languages that it's translated to and they replace what the R's stand for, no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you watch it in the cinema, this is not on the Netflix version, but at the main point of the film, there's a title card that says Interval with three R's.
I forgot about that. That was so
I love that.
It was honestly the most fun I've ever had in the cinema. I'm not exaggerating. It was bonkers. And like we were cheering with everyone. So my final question is, if Avatar is the main course, which film do you pick as dessert?
Well, depends. Is it a vegan dessert?
Vegetarian dessert.
Oh, then it couldn't be Okja.
It could be Okja.
Yeah, there's no milk being drunk in Okja.
The whole reason we picked this is because we weren't meant to take it literally.
So yeah, I'm not gonna go with my own pick of triple R. Like, I think all three of them. I'm having like a serious hard time to choose one of them. So I'd like to hear you guys' points first.
I think Technolust is like little cakes that you have with coffee rather than a whole dessert. Mm-hmm. It's a nice accent on the end of Avatar if you're into that specific trend of it. But I would probably say Okja for all the reasons we've said, and I just think it is such a lovely film, and it does take, I think it does go deeper into the exploitation of real world indigenous populations and of wildlife more generally. I also just think it's a really good film by a director I really like and was introduced to from a more popular film, but I think that, you know, people should watch more Bong Joon-ho films.
Yeah, this was my first Bong Joon-ho, actually.
Really?
Yeah,
see, mine was Parasite.
Yeah, no.
No, actually, mine was Snowpiercer.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay. What about you, Emma? If Avatar is the main course, which alternate is the dessert?
No, I would say in terms of a film that matches the spectacle of Avatar for its size, for its visual effects, for its themes, for its length, for the way that it managed to capture the imaginations and hearts of so many people, I would say RRR is a inspired equivalent, definitely a great complement to Avatar. And it's been a joy to get to know it through this podcast. I'm reluctant, however, to say that it is a dessert just because of the size. It's like, it would be like having a main course followed by a main course.
That sounds amazing.
Which I am not against, but it's just question.
In this hypothetical, you don't have to watch them back to back, literally.
Mm. You can take it home in a doggy bag.
Yeah.
I would say it would be an equivalent main course as opposed to a dessert.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make me love it in any different way. It's just different. Charlie, I really like your description of Technolust, and I would agree with you there. Maybe that would be a starter for me. It would kind of whet your appetite to some of the themes of AI and the lengths, like where could humans go, especially because it's sort of set now in the past, Avatar that is in the future. Therefore, to answer, circle back to your original question, I think I would say that Okja is the dessert because it follows similar themes to Avatar. It's perhaps a little bit lighter, easier to digest if you're already full from having had your mains. For me, it complements the themes, takes it somewhere new, and yeah, like you say, it's just a really lovely film. It was my first experience, like you, Francesco, with Bong Joon-ho, and I agree with you, Charlie. Everyone should kind of give him a go because his film's beautiful.
Give Bong Joon-ho a good old go.
Yeah. And yeah, no, and to finally answer myself, I think you guys answered for me, but I really loved your framing, Emma, of like Technolust as the starter, because Technolust is the only film in this list that was made before Avatar, a good 6 or 7 years before, and it was 6 or 7 years during which digital technology advanced so much, both in terms of like how we use it cinematically, but also in our daily lives. that Technolust really feels like it's commenting on that, and it's commenting on the more like technical, technological, nerdy questions that Avatar is asking, whereas the other two are maybe more resonant with its political stances and its target audience being a lot broader, with in different ways, with RRR being expressly an action blockbuster and Okja being more of a made for streaming film, but which nevertheless tries to condense some very, very complex and very, very difficult to deal with themes and, you know, show them in a light that will resonate with people and will emotionally move them, whilst at the same time using its budget and its technology to craft this alien being that is so beautiful and so artfully crafted. It's just a joy to look at. So yeah, like I don't have a single one for this episode that I would like to pick as my main pick.
So all that preamble, you don't have an answer. That was just the longest way of saying nothing I have ever heard.
Because it's like, I think all three of these are good. It's a marker of a good episode where I don't have one that I choose as a dessert over the others.
I'm just teasing you.
Yeah, but...
Said with love.
Yeah, depends on the... it's different types of dessert. Yeah.
Said with the same brotherly love that we saw in R.
So yeah, Technolust is cupcakes, RRR is ice cream tub, and Okja is a vegan ice cream tub. There you go.
Sure, mate. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, we can... whatever. Well, thank you, Emma, very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a joy.
Lovely to see you. It's really lovely to see you, as always.
And you. Always a joy.
And thank you, as always, to our producer, Jade. Thank you to Molecule for our artwork. You can follow us on social media at BCU Watch Pods on Twitter and at BCU Watch Podcast on Instagram. That's all from us. Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.